You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. I'm joined this month by two people who've been elected to very prestigious roles in the world of astronomy or science in general. I thought it was nice to talk about where some of these learned societies, as they're called, come from, or what their role is in science today. The two people in particular that I'm joined by are Professor Mike Edmonds and Professor Bernard Schutt. So welcome both to the programme. Mike, tell us what position you've just been elected to.
Thanks, Chris. I've been elected, well, I'm what I think was called president-elect, means that I have been elected to be next president of the Royal Astronomical Society, but that's not until next year that I actually take up post for 2 years. And in the intervening year, I serve on council and act as what's called, as I say, president-elect, presumably where I follow around and learn the ropes and learn what to do and what not to do.
Excellent. So we'll learn a little bit more about what the Royal Astronomical Society is all about in a short while. Bernard, yourself, what's your latest accolade?
Well, I had the great fortune of being elected a fellow of the Royal Society. And that's the Royal Society is far up as you can get in recognition in the UK and many would say in the world for the scientific work you've done. So I was very happy to have that honor bestowed on me this year.
Well, congratulations to both of you, first of all, for those, as you said, those honors, those accolades, those election results. Let's start off with they have similar names. You have the Royal Astronomical Society and the Royal Society. They are obviously, there's only one word between them, but they are slightly different beasts. The Royal Society is somewhat older. It's been around since Charles II was the person who founded it. And its full name, as I understand it, is the Royal Society of London for Improving Natural Knowledge. That's been the name it's had since 1660 or thereabouts. So it's 461 years old, I guess, nearly, if my maths is correct. Bernard, the motto, according to their website, the motto of the Royal Society is, and you'll have to forgive my Latin, is nullius in verba, which is take nobody's word for it, apparently. Where do you see the role of the Royal Society? You mentioned it's one of the most prestigious places in the UK and possibly the world. Where do you see its role in all of that?
Yeah, well, right from the beginning, the Royal Society was formed as a kind of group for people to talk about science based on evidence. And so take nobody's word for it. Means look at the real world and let experiment, let observation guide what you believe about it and what you conclude about it. In the 1600s, that was an idea that was taking root, but it was certainly not something that everybody subscribed to. So they were trying to push the idea of natural sciences and as a way forward for human thinking. Nowadays, science is embedded in our society, but it is still probably, if you look around today, worthwhile to keep saying, don't just take somebody's word for it. We have all sorts of problems that are scientific challenges, our current COVID challenge and many other challenges in the world. And we have to contend with all sorts of fake news and all sorts of things that are that people believe for no good reason, just because they had taken somebody's word for it. So I think the Royal Society recognizes that. It recognizes it has an important role with other these days with other national academies of its kind from other countries as well, including other ones in the UK, but also abroad. And these are challenging times for science. And so the advising government, making sure that the right people, that is the people who really know something, get onto governance committees and advisory boards. Publishing, the Royal Society does a lot of publishing of scientific articles with at the highest standards of refereeing and examination before they're allowed to be published. So that's what it does. And I guess we need it right now as much as we ever did.
And now, Mike, I know you've done, you've looked in the past at the history of science, the history of astronomy and various things. What Bernard was talking about there is that the idea of having this, base things on evidence. I mean, this is, some people call this the scientific method, is sometimes a phrase used for this idea of making sure you've got evidence for things. The Royal Society was in no, or the founding of the Royal Society was in no means the first time that scientific evidence, the scientific method had been put this way. But what kind of role do you think the Royal Society played, Mike, in formalizing it and giving it kind of credence?
I think it was a great talking shop, apart from anything else. Not only is, I think as Bernard was saying, publication has always, for both the societies, been very important, both debate and publication, the two things. Debate, when it could be done in person, particularly in London, of course, for both our societies over history. And also the fact that they had, as he said, if you have prestige publications that tend to be carefully looked at and rubbish is not published in them, those can circulate around the world, and then the ideas and the subjection of what do we mean by evidence, what will you accept as an argument, what becomes a theory and hypothesis, gradually builds up and it becomes accepted. Now, in fact, the history of the Royal Astronomical Society is a little bit related to the Royal Society. And of course, as always, societies don't necessarily see eye to eye. The way the Royal Astronomical Society apparently came about is that during the sort of end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, quite a lot of the sort of physical scientists, and particularly the mathematicians and astronomers in the Royal Society, got a little fed up, because they had a president then who was president for many years, Sir Joseph Banks, who was a remarkable scientist in his own way. But he had, shall we say, or tended towards the end of his life, really, to have rather fixed views. He wasn't quite so bad earlier on. Anyway, and so the sort of astronomers particularly felt he wasn't giving astronomy a fair crack of the whip at the Royal Society, and things weren't being discussed and one thing and another. So they set up their own society, what was called the Astronomical Society of London, in 1820, and that became the Royal Society in 1831. Now, in fact, to begin with, there was a slight strain of relationships between the two societies. In fact, Banks played a bit naughty and tried to get the society stopped. He even stopped one of his fellows from taking over as president and all sorts of things. But he died quite soon afterwards. Not that we would have liked him to have died, but he did die soon afterwards. And the next incoming president was much more amenable to the coexistence of the two societies. And I think, as far as I know, I haven't looked into the details of this, but I think since that time, relations on the whole have been pretty good between the two societies. Bernard may know if he knows of any particular spats during that time, but I can't think of any major spats that I know about during that time. And in fact, the two societies have slightly different outlooks. They have different clientele, as it were. The Royal Society is quite an exclusive society. And I mean that in the nicer sense, in the sense that they, if somebody gets to be in the Royal Society, these are really good scientists. I'll spare your blushes, Bernard, but it's true. These are, really good scientists. The Royal Astronomical Society is a much more open society in the sense that you have to be elected to be a fellow or a junior member or whatever it is, but that's not a difficult process. And it contains many more sort of what I won't say average scientists, but run of the road and practicing scientists rather than the very top scientists. So it's a slightly different sort of professional body. Both of them have their roles and both very important, I think.
I would say that probably after 1820, the two societies began to diverge in their concept of what they were for. So the Royal Society is now an overarching society in the sense that it has all the sciences in it, all the physical sciences and more, the biological sciences and so on, and so And each of these different scientific fields has their own professional society, like the Royal Astronomical Society serves astronomers. There's the Institute of Physics in the UK for physicists. And so I would guess that every astronomer who's in the Royal Society is also a member of the Royal Astronomical Society. That's where you really do the business of astronomy. It's the Royal Society is where you do the business of, I guess, where science impacts society, things like that.
So is that so where science impacts society sort of writ large? I mean, there's really...
Writ large, yes. And the interactions between the different fields too. If you want to put together a committee that has that has people from lots of different fields on it, then you would be looking to the Royal Society for advice. Yeah.
I've certainly been to, I went to a session on, you know, astrobiology and so on a good few years ago now, but that kind of thing where it's these interdisciplinary fields, it's certainly important for. Now, Mike, the you mentioned that the Royal Astronomical Society, so it came around the early 19th century. So it's 200 years old, 201 years old this year. It's Royal Charter. I was looking up its Royal Charter to see what it was, what you have to do according to King William IV, is it? Who's essentially told the royal, well, decreed that it was a royal society, or a royal body, had its royal assent. And so it's things like the encouragement and promotion of astronomy and having its library of and instruments and so on that it can loan out, and publications you mentioned, but a line in there was promoting the general spirit of inquiry in astronomical subjects, and that, although as you said, the Royal Society is big on the way science interacts with society, the Royal Astronomical Society, as you alluded to, is a lot about the promotion of astronomy as a field, and not just amongst professional scientists. It has a really large role more generally with general society, doesn't it?
Indeed, it has a big public presence. There are some fellows of the Royal Society who are not professional astronomers, but are amateur astronomers, amateur in the best sense of loving the subject. And historically, it has quite a long history of having members who were not professionals, as were in the past, though not so much now, obviously, was true of the Royal Society. And the motto of the Royal Astronomical Society, as you may know, if I get it right, quinquid nitet notandum, whatever shines should be observed. Again, this is the, as you're talking about, the spirit of inquiry. And that was one of the things that they set off to do, was that the idea was that maybe the society should organize things to observe everything in the sky. Which is interesting because it's taken over 200 years and we're still not there yet in the sense that there were surveys did begin of the sky, and you're starting with the sort of brighter stars that could be done in those days. And now it's got much, much fainter until you realize that once you start doing that in the end, you realize it's impossible as a human problem to some extent. There's so many objects in the sky that it would be impossible to observe them all until, of course, we've got computers and now we've got artificial intelligence and so on to link algorithms to do searches, where actually that sort of thing of observing the whole sky and maybe over every few weeks is becoming a real possibility. Which is a fascinating thought, but it's taken something like 200 years to be able to get that far to actually fulfill that particular aspect of looking at the universe.
I think there's another aspect of it as well that the Royal Astronomical Society gets involved with, which is protection of the skies in some respects. And there's lots of debate going on at the moment, not just about light pollution, but also about things like satellite constellations that are... people are arguing they're polluting the skies in terms of making it much more difficult to do astronomy, and that the wonders of the night sky are being lost. So there's part of that element of protecting the field, if you like, standing up for the field against other people.
That's an interesting one, because I think we did lose, and it has to be, I think, admitted, for the humanity lost something when we got street lighting and city lighting, and that you could no longer, from night to night, see and react to the sky that was there. I mean, it's half your vision if you go out at night, probably more than that, because the rest of it's pretty dark. And just that sort of background that, you know, you live in this amazing place that you never really think of necessarily in your day-to-day life, except when you go out and look up and realize that they're much greater things than this little a ball of dust. And the whole business of light pollution that stops you doing that, which might be a nice thing to do, has other aspects too, of course, that's much wider now. There's the impact of lighting on the natural world, on other animals, birds, insects, goodness knows what. That's now in a very active area of study and realizing that there are implications there. And also a colleague of mine, in fact, connected with the University College London, is doing some interesting research now to show that, in fact, some of the modern street lights, in fact, may be doing us quite a lot of damage. There may be literal some quite bad physiological effects of blue light, which has come in modern street lights with the LEDs and things, that there is a much, much bluer component in modern street lighting than there was. And that, in fact, may actually be having some not awfully good physiological and psychological consequences. So it starts off as being something that is important for looking at the sky light pollution, and it comes down to a lot of other problems too that are common to humanity. And I think Bernard would probably agree as well. He said that. Perhaps he can give some other examples where this is an interesting thing about, you know, people say, well, astronomy, do we really need astronomy? And you say, well, look, it's not just astronomy, which is a great thing in itself. There are all these spin-offs. You can't justify thinking only on spin-offs, but do notice all these various things. The development of light detectors, for example, and infrared detectors and so on has been very much aided, I believe, by astronomical research during the past few years. I think the whole business of a lot of computing, although you don't notice it, particularly on large data sets, again, has been driven a lot by astronomical and particle physics needs. So astronomy does put something back in society as well as living off it.
I know that you're both based in Cardiff, and you both started in Cardiff at Cardiff University within a few months of each other, I believe, back in the 70s. The world of scientific research has changed since the 1970s. We now have personal computers that didn't really exist at all back then. So I wonder what your thoughts are about how science has changed and how you think it might change in the future. Where are we heading with this? I mean, Mike, you mentioned big data sets and artificial intelligence and things like that. So I'll come to you first, Bernard. Where do you think science is going to be heading, and what are things that in the Royal Society and other societies like it, what part are they going to play in the next decade or two of scientific research, do you think?
Oh, that's a really profound question, and it's dangerous to look into the crystal ball, but but also really, really interesting to speculate. I think Mike has hit one of the themes very strongly. That is, because we have computers and other and computer-driven automatic data acquisition systems, we have a huge amount of data now that we mine as well as we can, but contains a lot of information where we're not even asking the right questions, probably. But artificial intelligence that we can apply to it to get information out has been extremely important, and that will continue to be important. That's true in all fields of astronomy. It's true right across all of the sciences. Another really strong trend, of course, is the interdisciplinary trend, that the boundaries between what we call different sciences are melting quite fast. And so the huge progress that there's been in, for instance, the neurosciences and understanding the brains of animals and so on, is a lot of it is rooted in technologies like MRIs that came out of the world of physics, and that some of them were assisted by technologies that came in from astronomy themselves. And then the questions that come out, because you're suddenly dealing with physical systems, the if we're talking about the nervous system or something, it's a logical system. So it has some computer aspects. It's a physical system. So you have chemists, you have physicists as well as biologists. So one of the challenges, for instance, that for universities is how do we adapt to giving young people the right kind of education to be able to move across boundaries and to be able to move to be able to work in these multidisciplinary areas. And for the Royal Society, as an advisor to the government, as something that looks after the health of science and its relationship to society in general, it sponsors a lot of meetings and tries to bring groups together, and it publishes journals where there's a strong emphasis on accepting articles that have importance not just to their own field but to other fields. So these are things that are coming, but they're really challenging problems as science sort of gets reconfigured into let's work on the most interesting problems at some frontier, and let's not worry about what, you know, whether that frontier is called chemistry or biology or physics or geology or whatever.
Yeah, the universe doesn't care what name we've put on a problem.
Exactly. And the wonderful thing, should I say, the wonderful thing about astronomy, and I came up, Mike and I began at Cardiff in the same time, but also in the same group, we began as astronomers. Great thing about astronomy that it has that it offers to teach to other sciences is that you're studying the whole system. You don't have a choice when you're studying a star I'm only going to study stars that are composed of, let's say, electrons, or only going to study stars that do one kind of thing. A lot of fundamental physics is involved in simplification and looking at very simple systems. But astronomy from the beginning has had to deal with the whole complex systems, and stars and galaxies and the way the universe evolved are all complex systems. And so it has a lot of heritage and a lot of experience at how to draw scientific inferences from limited amounts of data. You can't experiment with a star. You can't go out there and poke it. You can't nudge it. You can't make it do things. You have to wait until you see what it does. And it's only going to give you a limited amount of information, what it chooses to give you. And so making scientific inferences from large data sets, from limited amounts of information, is something astronomers have built up a lot of skill with. And I think those are skills that also can usefully be transferred to many other fields now, because lots of fields are dealing with very complex systems now.
One thing I'd say about interdisciplinary research, I've done some myself, and as Bernard was saying about how do you educate for that? And I think maybe in a way you can't, other than keeping minds very open and getting people to be able to communicate freely. Because my experience was you made progress in interdisciplinary research, not when somebody tried to become an expert necessarily in another field, but if you got experts from different fields to talk together and work on a common problem. And then they would educate each other as time went on also, because they had their particular viewpoint. And different viewpoints on the same problem was what really led forward to the thing. You can't. It's very difficult, I think, to make a true single interdisciplinary scientist. You have interdisciplinary teams. That's how I think it works. And I assume that's a trend that's going to continue into the future. That where people are doing joint research, you know, interdisciplinary research, it'll be teams that really make the difference. There may be some critical and particular individuals in those who have a particularly big influence, but a lot of it will be from joint teams, I suspect. Mm. It's interesting, you're asking when we first started. I remember when we first started in Cardiff all those years ago, just after the Ark had come to dry land, if I remember. And we got some of the first Hewlett-Packard calculators, you know, the ones you could start to program in reverse Polish notation. I don't know if you remember, but this was fantastic.
I do very well.
This was fantastic. You could do these calculations, you know, and program it. Wonderful. And then I remember, I don't think Bernard knows this. I think I was not a judge. I don't think it was one of his grants, but for one of the research councils for during the gravitational waves investigations. And they were setting up to do gravitational wave calculations and data processing on the results coming in. I remember we had to agonize over funding for the memory requirements of the computers, which were going to agonize to organize this. And I think they needed something. It was something like a few terabytes was what they were after. And this cost a phenomenal amount of money. I mean, I don't think it went in the hundreds of thousands. It was certainly many tens of thousands of pounds. Well, you can go down the store now and for I should think probably about 20, 25 quid, you can buy a terabyte memory drive. Now that is just completely unexpected of what would have happened. That sort of change in the affordability of memory and the capacity that now gives you that we could not have dreamt of having that capacity before. The only trouble about it is, does it make us lazy in our programming, which is one of the problems of things. So you just get a whole load of sort of memory just really not doing anything, a bit like human DNA with all those useless bits mixed up with the rest. And I always had this sort of idea that, you know, you're looking to the future, you'd have some theorist who is assembling a model of a galaxy, because we want to understand galaxies and their evolution. And they put all the stellar evolution in there, they have code for that. And they put in all the dynamic evolution, they have code for that. And they put in all the dark matter evolution, they have for that. And then they have the dark energy coming up, and they have all the, and they have all this wonderful code and the whole thing. And they put it all together and gradually. And it looks, suddenly in the end, they've got it looks exactly like a galaxy. And it behaves exactly like a galaxy. And then they realize they're looking at a galaxy. And they can't tell one from the other. But what have they learned in the process? Other than an awful lot of laws went in. But which were the important ones? And that's a little thing that does worry me a little bit about going into the future, where you don't have huge amounts of computing and whatever. And this was particularly during the 1920s, if you look at that, the way people worked out the structure of stars, with basically little more than a calculator and a pad and some simplifying physical laws. Yet they got a fantastic way of understanding how the universe worked from that. And I do wonder a little bit that as we get these fantastic things, you can do wonderful things on them, but it's not obvious that you're immediately going to understand better what is going on. You may be able to simulate it a bit better, but I think there's still a great deal of opportunity for people to think more and understand more, as well as being able to simulate more. Mm.
Now, I mean, Bernard, this is something in your particular area of research, the gravitational wave and in general relativity and so on, which is of course that research is what the recognition of the as fellow of the Royal Society is for. What Mike just mentioned about having to do things in a sensible way is actually becoming very important there as well, because you can have machine learning or artificial intelligence algorithms do all manner of things, but in the end, they still do what always happens, is they find what you're looking for. You find what you're looking for, generally, or you're only really sensitive to the things that you maybe expect to look. They're a little bit more advanced, but is that a concern in that specific field as well, that we're looking to prove general relativity right, and so are we ever going to be able to prove it wrong if we're not looking for the right things? That kind of idea. Is that a concern for you, do you think?
There is a concern. We're not yet dominated in gravitational wave analysis of the data that we're getting. We're not yet dominated by machine learning discovery. So we have algorithms that make sure that we detect, that we can find everything that we are actually looking for. The problem comes when you ask, well, am I missing something because I didn't expect it? And I think that's true of, just of life. I mean, the things that you don't expect, you probably don't notice until they jump out at you and they're in your face. And then you make that discovery. So or you're very lucky and they turn out in some corner. But basically, with gravitational waves, we're going step by step with increased sensitivity of our detectors. Every year or so, we shut down for a year or sometimes more to do an upgrade in sensitivity. And that means that anything that was maybe just at the level of noise that we hadn't expected, something new that nobody had predicted, but we didn't really get a good handle on it. We didn't know that it was really a real signal because it could have been something weird from our detector or something. If we have now twice the sensitivity and that same thing happens again, then it'll stand up very strongly above the noise. And so that's when you start detecting. I've been saying this for many years when I've given talks on the future of gravitational wave detection, that in the beginning we will be discovering things that were sort of what we expected. And we did expect the things, the binary systems, two objects, two compact objects like stars or neutron stars or black holes, spiraling together as they emit gravitational waves, losing energy, spiraling together very fast and finally colliding. That we expected. And what we're seeing is many more, particularly of the black holes. And the black holes are much more massive. So it's a good thing that we extended, you know, our searches over big mass ranges. But still, that as a system, that's what we expected to see. But I think with the next generation of upgrades, so coming up in the next 5 to 10 years, there's a very good chance that we'll finally begin to discover things that we hadn't expected. And that'll be, you know, one of the most interesting phases of gravitational wave science.
And coming back to the more immediate future, Mike, you're now president-elect of the Royal Astronomical Society. I'm not sure whether your term as president-elect officially has started yet, but you're about to spend about a year in that role, and then you become fully-fledged president for 2 years. Do you have a vision for what will happen over that 2 years, of where the Royal Astronomical Society might go? I mean, 2 years is a very small bit of its history. You know, I assume you, well, you may be. I imagine you're not intending to try and rip up the rule book.
It's tempting, isn't it? Yeah. It's tempting. Yeah. No, I think what one's looking for in the immediate future is, two things really I'm particularly looking for is continuity. In particular, picking up in the post-COVID world, because an awful lot of careers and students and so on will have been disrupted by this last couple of years with COVID and disruption and so on. And that will have two knock-on effects. One is in individual careers and helping people and giving advice and maybe even putting in place a particular schemes to help people who really have had disrupted careers through no real fault of their own and need some help to get back and advice to get back onto a normal mainstream sort of professional career. The second thing, which I think we must all inevitably worry about, and I'm sure it's true for the Royal Society too, and I'm sure they'll be doing everything they can about this. Countries have borrowed an awful lot of money to overcome. It's been necessary to overcome this pandemic, and let's hope to God it does get overcome in the fairly short term. But then one worries very much about what the financial outlook will be for science after the pandemic and the sort of the chickens come home to roost on the financial side. Now, one thing we could say, I suppose, is look, science essentially has saved you. If you did not have good virology, and this incredible thing of developing a vaccine in a time that scale, which on normal vaccine timescale production is extremely short, also that the vaccine itself seems, and as far as I can tell, this is true, to have been incredibly successful and presumably can be tweaked for other variants and so on as time goes by. It's been a very, very wonderful scientific success story. We could say, well, look, if you hadn't had those virologists, if you hadn't had that knowledge, most of you would be dead, or a lot of you would be dead now. Just don't tell us that, I'm sorry, we've got to go into an austere period where we can't have any scientific research. It's much more important that we do other things.
So I think, you know, we could argue from that that science is, it's an example where science is important, but you never know quite, Nick, where you're going to need what your scientific advance is going to be, whether it's going to be medicine, energy production. There's obviously the whole climate change thing and energy production, so on, where good scientific and then good technological things that can be transferred into engineering need to be done. And you don't know where they're coming from. It's very difficult to plan to say, right, we will have this technological advance. Technological advance can't be planned for. They can be recognized and fostered, but it's very, very difficult to say, I'm going to invent a new widget that will power the world. It doesn't work like that. What that comes from is a healthy scientific endeavor of all kinds within countries and internationally. And I do worry about the maintenance of that. And that's one of the main issues that I think we will be tackling in the next 2 years.
It's certainly going to be a very testing time for science. As you say, the role that science has played in the last 18 months in overcoming this virus, as you say, hopefully is on the way to being overcome is huge. And actually, I know one of the things that the Royal Society did, I'm not sure how aware and informed you are about all these developments, Bernard, but one of the things that the Royal Society did was really try to promote other people getting involved in that research. So Michael used to earlier, or Mike mentioned earlier, the interdisciplinarity comes from having experts meet rather than experts trying change their career. And that's something that the Royal Society really tried to foster with this, to say, look, we need, yes, it's about virology and epidemiology and DNA sequencing and so on. It's also about modelling and predicting and social science, because, you know, if you tell people to stay at home, will they stay at home? And then economics as well. How do you support people? There's a huge amount of work needs to go into this. And that's something I know the Royal Society has been quite fundamental in nurturing and supporting that kind of
work. That's exactly right. That's one of the main functions of a national academy like this. I'm a member as well of the American National Academy, the National Academy of Sciences, and they've been doing exactly the same sort of thing, putting together committees where they try to bring together the best expertise in all these related fields to address the pandemic. And I think Mike hit the nail on the head. As we look to the future, if the pandemic does subside, if we get a chance to draw a breath, we need to draw a breath just in order to be ready to face the next challenge of climate change and global warming. And that is even more interdisciplinary. That is even requires even more science-based, science-conscious activity from the government, I would say, to stimulate the right kinds of industries to enable the energy conversion.
The other thing I think Bernard mentioned earlier is education. And this is one role too, where both societies have do have a lot of activity and would like to work further, is that we do realize that there's a need for good scientists in this world. And how do you get people into scientists? Particularly, how do you make sure scientists come from all ethnic groups, all backgrounds, whatever, into science, where they'll be welcome? How do you inspire young people that science, at all levels, and there are all sorts of levels and things you can do in science and engineering, technology. How do you show pupils at school that there are really good jobs, really interesting jobs, and that there is a role for many of them in, not everybody, we've all got different aptitudes and enjoy doing different things. But there is seriously a need of making sure that students at school and in colleges realise the careers that are possible for them and get them young enough, as it were, so that they have the tools, the mathematics, the scientific outlook, basic science, in order to be able to take up those careers. And that's a very important role that the main societies do play. And encouraging government, again, to make sure they have the right supply of teachers and good teachers who enjoy their job, are up to it, and well supported in modern science and modern science ideas through continuing professional development throughout their lives.
We have a knowledge-based society, and it starts right at the beginning. And starts at the young ages, and the government really needs to protect that and enhance it. Otherwise, we can't face the challenges that are still coming.
So we need people that are well informed enough about scientific processes and the scientific world to be able to contribute to future generations of, as you say, whatever challenges are going to come, because things like climate change, I guess, are not going to be something where, like, this pandemic has been a huge amount of money for a couple of years and then fingers crossed it goes away. Climate change is, even with a couple of years of lots of funding, is not going anywhere. That's a bulldozer that's coming to that is going to be very hard to stop or turn around, I guess. So it's a trying time. It's going to be a difficult time for science, but it's wonderful that we've got these scientific societies, learner societies, the national academies to support this.
The only other thing I'd say, I guess, for both our societies is just what I'd, well, I don't want to call it education because it's the wrong word, general information and awareness for the general public of scientific issues. And, you know, as you say, there's this problem with false news and conspiracy theories and so on. And it's a major problem. I don't know if the Royal Society, in fact, might have set up a committee on it. If it hasn't done, which is, how do you combat misinformation? You know, this sort of spread of stuff on social media that has no scientific backing is whatever. How do you form a balance between what we called a sensible debate and a fringe debate? Because some scientific debates, you've got 500 people on one side and one on the other. And it's ridiculous to take the one. But then you've got to be careful that you don't have one where you really do suppress the one person who is right and the 500 aren't. And that trying to draw, you know, balance how you do the information and educate people so that they, well, educate, I don't know if that's the right word, maybe you can do it through education, is that they hear what's on the news or they see what's on social media and they think, is this right? Where do I go to find out whether this really is right if I want to know? And this terrible effect at the moment is if you just watch one kind of social media, what's it called, the echo chamber effect, where you just look and you just hear this thing echoing. And that does worry me because I get the feeling that that's affecting not only some of the population, but some politicians now too, who only really listen to one particular view. And that can be worrying.
Yeah, it's certainly a concern, particularly I think it's not just the politicians and what they're listening to, but also the audience they're playing to.
Yeah.
Like they know if they speak into an echo chamber, in that echo chamber, they'll get the support they need. And it doesn't matter if there's another echo chamber that's saying something else, they can ignore that echo chamber.
Yeah. That's a very good point.
Yeah, that's right. They're doing it. That's mendacious. I think the other thing that, I don't know, we didn't touch on, but, you know, it's very wide ranging, is in a sense, public understanding of the science of science in terms of what is the scientific method, or how do scientists do things. And I think too many people think that scientists are experts who know things instead of understanding that scientists are people who are driven by their curiosity to try to find some things out, but also are different from other kinds of people with curiosity in the fact that they have to be very skeptical. So that kind of skepticism is totally missing from these echo chambers where people see something on Facebook and they think, oh yeah, I'd like to believe that, so I guess I will. You know,
even yeah, there's confirmation bias, incredible. I guess, of hearing something actually, and that supports right. my what I thought was true already. So
that's right. Instead of having that sort of skepticism that I think most scientists try to keep in the back of their mind.
A really good scientist will be happier to be wrong than to be right, if that makes sense. In other words, you often make progress when you find out something you thought is wrong, and you have to rethink and find out what actually does fit the evidence right. better. But actually, that takes quite a lot of psychological character to actually be able to do that. And in fact, science often progresses by people dying.
that's right. But we have other things built into the scientific system besides waiting for people to die. So we do have refereeing of papers and things like that, where we apply skepticism from outside before ideas get too far.
I think one of the things that's always discussed about science is a very creative field. Science is something where you need creativity, you need imagination. And one of the things that I get the feeling is often misunderstood is that idea, as you say, of having to make sure everything is right, is that sometimes this feeling there's basically a checklist. And you have an idea and you want to go and test it and you run down the checklist. And that doesn't sound very creative as a process. Now, of course, in reality, how you go down that checklist and check it, you haven't missed anything and check that there's nothing you've missed is a creative process, because you have to figure out all sorts of weird and wonderful ways of doing so. But actually, that very first step, I mean, yes, science is based on testing evidence and so on, but a lot of science experiments start with, I guess, sometimes what's almost a hunch of going, this thing sounds like it might be something. I'm going to try we're going to try and see whether this is right. And as you said, Mike, often it's not. And that's fine. 90% of stuff scientists do should turn out to be wrong. If everyone's being creative and trying everything, and that doesn't tend to get much funding from governments.
Yeah, well, it's very difficult. If you're on a research committee, you get in 10 proposals. You can only fund one. Which one are you going to go for? And that's very difficult. It's much easier if you have 10, you can fund five, knowing that two or three of them won't work. But the one you're not quite sure about might be far better than any of the other ones. It's a real problem. It's a real problem that you just for confirmation bias, you never fund anything that's particularly unusual and interesting.
Now, it's going to be a difficult time for science, but it's wonderful that we've got these scientific societies, learner societies, the national academies to support this. I thank you both very much for your thoughts on the history of science and what the future might hold. So Professor Bernard Schütz and Professor Mike Edmonds, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Indeed.
That's it for this month. Don't forget you can listen to past episodes and subscribe to the podcast at pythagastro.uk, or you can search for us on Spotify. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.